This is 2FM's Game On.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You're very welcome to tonight's edition of Game On. Thank you very much to Demi and to Mikey for taking us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 14th of October. You're listening to an extended Game On as we bring you live coverage of the Republic of Ireland's World Cup qualifier against Armenia.
We'll be crossing to the Aviva shortly to catch up with Marie and her guests. But as well as that, we'll talk all the European World Cup qualifiers with Mark Langdon, racing with William Buick, and the history of the World Cup with Jonathan Wilson.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can text us. Our number is 51552. You can WhatsApp 087 187 9200. Or you'll find us across social media at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Ruby, how are you?
I'm great. And yourself, Damien?
Not too bad now. I'm alive and well. And listen, doesn't it say, God be with the days you'd be getting all set and looking forward to a friendly against like Oman or somebody. But here we are tonight now, hoping we can get a result against a mighty Armenia.
Not hoping, Damien. Hoping. It's a requirement.
Yeah, I know. But would you be... Listen, I'm all into realistic expectation. And you as an elite sportsman would know there's nothing worse in life than people building up the hope, the hype on you of something beyond what it is you're capable of on a given day. But how have we got to the stage where here we are ahead of a game against Armenia and we're quaking in our boots to an extent?
Yeah, well, there is nothing worse than the pressure of expectation when you believe that you can't deliver. That is an awful pressure. And I have experienced that, but such is life. But I still don't think... Oh, look, I'm not a soccer expert by any imagination or means, but I do think that we are capable of holding Armenia scoreless and nicking the one or maybe even a second one that we need, Damien. Yeah. I don't think it'll be beautiful to watch, but I have never been a believer in what's good to watch. I'm a results-based man.
We'll wait and see how it all plays out. We've another retirement. Megan Campbell announcing her retirement from professional football at the age of 32. It's been an unbelievable run over the course of the last week in terms of elite female footballers walking away. Like, she's, you know, we could do what Megan Campbell in the long throws tonight.
Yeah, we could. Or bring back Rory Delap, even for the long throws. But yeah, look, incredible career that Megan Campbell had. And yeah, as you said, it's what was 4 or 5 over the weekend, and Megan adds to that list. But it's a changing of the guard for women's football, isn't it?
It's the qualifier tonight and the qualifiers over the course of the week which have really dominated. A lot of fallout again on the story last night. I know you talked about it, about Shane Ryan and the enhanced games, and we're going to talk to Mark Langdon in just a minute about the rest of the night's European action and everything else that's coming up. But the more you hear about Shane Ryan, the more you hear about the enhanced games, the more you wonder, money aside, rationally, why would anyone want to get involved in it?
I don't know. And only Shane Ryan can speak about that and as to what his rationale behind his thinking was or why he wants to do it. But I don't think you can leave the money aside, Damien. I think the money is the reason that you're doing it. I mean, he's probably achieved all he can in what we would call, I don't even know what the right way is to phrase this, traditional swimming?
Yeah.
Is that the right way? In traditional sport? Conventional? I think he's achieved all he can. Yeah. So he's trying something new, but it wouldn't be for me. It wouldn't be for me.
The only benefit I can see in this, and I know it sounds even bizarre to use the word benefit about, like, for people who aren't aware, it's going to be a scenario, it's going to be a sporting discipline through which the athletes who compete under supervision are going to be allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs. You know, the only thing that I would pay any attention to this for is what percentage gain is there?
And well, if it comes
to trying to eradicate doping from, do we now need to call it conventional sport or traditional sport? If you're in a situation with the likes of a Shane Ryan and you can say, well, in 2024 or 2025, he swam this, and now in the enhanced games, he swam that, does it allow you a mechanism through which you can look at other sports and say, okay, there's a 6% marginal gain, there's a 7% marginal gain, and that you can use it then to eradicate people that are trying to cheat? Now, he's not cheating, he's taking part in what is a relatively controversial endeavour, but like, other than the money, I just don't see the attraction.
I know it's under medical supervision, but I'm not so sure, and again, I'm far from a doctor, but I still don't believe how taking any of that in the long run can be good for you. Now, hang on, I smoked and I do drink, so I'm not pretending to be holier than thou.
Yeah.
But I don't see how being on known performance enhancing drugs can actually be of any good to you.
But the other thing as well is we have 40, 50, 60, 70 years of research about the effect of alcohol and the effect of nicotine, whereas you've got drugs and performance enhancers which are developing on a weekly basis that we don't have any knowledge of.
Well, you look at anybody in the world who unfortunately is sick and they have to take steroids.
Yeah.
They don't take them long term.
Yeah. Right, let's move away from all of that onto the main event of the evening. 7:45 kickoff at the Aviva Stadium. This programme is extended until 10 o'clock for coverage of the World Cup qualifier against Armenia. 7:45 kickoff, but let's get a sense of what awaits at the Aviva Stadium. Good evening, Marie Crowe.
Good evening, guys. I hope you're well. It is. There's a sense of apprehension, I think, around the Aviva Stadium at the moment. Not a lot of confidence, but lots of fans expected. They're looking over 45,000. The weather looks like it could turn very quickly, though. Grey, heavy clouds hanging over the Aviva Stadium. No sign of any blue skies whatsoever. But look, that might suit Ireland. We don't know yet. Pat Fenlon is here beside me. Pat, when you look back at the Portugal game and the positives from that, are there things that this Ireland team can build on here?
Yeah, I think what they will build on is they'll take confidence out of performance against Portugal. It's a completely different type of game because we know going to Portugal that they're going to have to be resolute, they're going to have to work really hard. It's probably the criticism from the previous Armenia game in relation to an Irish team where they sort of let themselves down. They didn't work as hard as the Armenian team, you know, and we gave up cheap goals and cheap possession. Portugal's a bit different, you know, you've got to be on it. If you're not on it, you're going to get real tank. And so I think the one thing you'll take out is confidence. Obviously, we've lost the game, which is the most important thing. And there's no good defeats. But if you're looking from the Armenia game to the Portugal game, they will definitely take a bit of confidence out. The shape of the team is the key for me as well. I think the three at the back suits what we have in relation to the squad. Does he tinker? We've seen the manager change a lot of personnel on a regular basis. So I'd like to see us get to a formation that we stick rigidly with. You know, obviously in international football, it's very difficult to pick the same team on a regular basis because you have injuries and suspensions like you do have tonight. But a similar shape that everybody knows their roles in there. Again, it's a bit different tonight. Although we've seen with Armenia in the away leg, the possession base, they keep the ball really well. Technically, good team. Like I said, hoarders an area. So, again, we're going to be... There's an expectancy a little bit tonight on the back of, and we've been here before. Jeez, that wasn't a bad performance. Can we go and win the game now? And everybody, like you say, is a little bit apprehensive. Have we got that in the locker to go and turn this team over?
We are waiting team news, but just to pick you up on a couple of things there, Pat, and you mentioned what let this Ireland team down in that Armenia defeat was the fact that they didn't work hard enough and they weren't really doing the basics right. They always get criticised, but this time it feels like they were criticised more than ever, and they do seem to have bounced back from that. Are they simple things that they can fix?
I think as a footballer, the last thing you want to be accused of is not working hard enough. And I think even listening to one or two of the players after the Armenia game and in the aftermath of the Portugal game, that they felt they got a little bit of that back. I think they took it on the chin that the team wasn't together in Armenia. We didn't work hard enough as a unit. We didn't stick to the game plan. We didn't get about people. I said in the commentary on the analysis on against Portugal that we got up against them, you know, in the game. We they were real strong midfield, but with Cullen and Malumbi at least put themselves about, got tight to people, squared off with people, made people play under pressure where we didn't see that Armenia. They played around us too easy. So I think that it did hurt. You're hoping that's a catalyst for tonight to say, well, it's still fresh in the memory because not that long ago. But also, I'm looking at the other way. Armenia coming here tonight, looking, we've beaten Ireland already. We beat them tonight. They're out of group. We're in second place if Portugal beat Hungary. So it's a huge game for them as well.
Yeah, it is an absolutely huge game. And it's going to be a game where we're going to need our leaders to stand up. And that's the narrative that has been around this team now as well, Pat, that there is a leadership deficit within this Ireland squad. Do you go along with that?
Probably to a point. I think that's why probably Seamus came back into the team and you've seen his leadership qualities. Even having someone like Seamus around the group all week, you know, putting that message across. This is what an Irish team's about. This is what we thrive on. This is what we do really well. Forget the rest of it. This is the bit that we need to get right. And if we get a bit of luck on the night, and we didn't get luck to you tonight, to be fair, the penalty decision is poor against us. Late goal. So, but having him around the group and then in the team, the concern with Seamus is, has he got the legs to come and play again tonight after? You haven't seen the team yet, but you'd like to think that he has enough about him that he's a good pro and get himself right. And I'm hoping he's in the team for that attribute that he brings. He brings confidence to the squad. He very rarely lets us down. He's a good communicator. He's a good organiser. So, but there's probably not loads more. If you look around the team that played the other side, there's lads that have played, like Nathan Collins played a bit, O'Shea has played a bit, you know, Cullen's played a bit. So they should be able to. Leadership is in different things. You know, you can have a talk or a scream, or you can have someone who goes about their business in the right way and shows people how they want the team to play and how they can affect that team. So there is some young players in there. There's some players in there who haven't played loads of games. So that's, I think a lot of this stuff is about confidence. You know, people can talk about leadership, but confidence is the biggest thing in football. This team is coming off the back of a lot of difficult results, poor results. Armenia added to that. But like you said, they've got a little bit of confidence back from the performance in Portugal. So we hope we're seeing that tonight.
Were they a little bit passive on the line, do you think? Because that has also come under focus too, that Hamerhall Grimson maybe should have been a little bit more aggressive in his reaction and actions. And then does that seep into the team?
I don't know, because every manager's different. I would have been accused of being too active on the line, where other managers would be
balance
very calm.
Balance,
Pat. Yeah, it is getting the balance right. But I think over your course of your career, you maybe change. But okay, the manager's not going to change. That's the way he sees. He maybe thinks I'm in more control when I'm not, you know, when I'm not that anxious about things and I can see things a little bit clearer. You know, it's good staff around you. Listen, the manager can only do so much in the soil, and when he's throwing his arm in the air, ranting and raving, you've got 50,000 people. You're not going to hear most of it. So I think it's just about the players for me. Once they cross that white line, they've been given the instructions, they know the game plan, stick to it. But like I said, the big complaint of Armenia is we didn't work hard enough.
Yeah, they seem to have grasped that as well and want to give reaction to that criticism. Are you positive about tonight, Pat Finlay?
Listen, this group of players would be desperate to win tonight. They've had so much stick and criticism, and particularly home games. This is where we need to start turning the screw. When we play teams that are around us within our groups, we have to start winning them at home. Talking is cheap. You've got to go and do it on the pitch.
Okay, well, hopefully they will do it on the pitch. Pat Fennon, thank you. You'll be staying with me for the evening. Keith Tracy will also be joining us as well. For now, though, bye from the Aviva and back to you in studio.
Thanks, Marie. I hope you enjoy the Aviva. Myself and Damien are here in the studio. She gets all the good jobs, Damien, doesn't she?
Sure, look, listen. What else would you like to do now? Tuesday, then sit in a padded room in the basement of a building talking to yourself, hoping that there's someone listening, you know?
It's all about perspective. Praying for a result.
It's all about perspective. I'm happy to be here with you. That's all that matters, you know?
Thank you so much, Damien. That's reassuring.
You're meant to say you're happy to be here with me too.
I was taking the reassuring part out of it there. Mm. Thanks. I'm delighted to be with you, Damien.
Thanks.
Mark Langdon joins us on the line as well. Mark, 4/5 of this island will be watching what goes on tonight, but 1/5 are watching last night. Northern Ireland just went down to the Germans.
Oh, they did. You know, in terms of the result, you know, they're still in a sort of playoff spot because of the Nations League performance. So, you know, there's that to sort of cling to. I just like the way, actually, that O'Neill has just got them sort of playing together. You know, there's a unified team. Supporters are excited about watching the team. They play in quite an aggressive way. You know, it's full of young players that are coming through together. You know, even if results, you know, do go against them for the rest of this campaign, I think you can see what they're building on what they're trying to be. And I think the future is really bright for Northern Ireland. Obviously, it was a tough game against Germany, but I watched them on the Friday night against Slovakia, thought they were outstanding and showed what can be achieved if everybody's pulling in the same direction.
They have to go away to Slovakia, who they've beaten already, and then have Luxembourg at home. So they do have two OK games coming up for where they are.
I think Slovakia will be... Slovakia were missing a couple of players. Lobotka was the big one on Friday night. He kind of makes them tick, and, you know, Windsor Park or playing away. I think, you know, they're two completely different games. So I would expect to see a different Slovakia for that match. In terms of Luxembourg... Yeah, I mean, that is eminently winnable match. But like I say, at the moment, they are one of those four teams alongside Wales, Romania, I think Sweden, who are, because of their Nations League performances, could still be in a World Cup playoff against one of those teams that finishes second.
The Scotland campaign, Group C, level on points with Denmark. They've to play Greece and Denmark still to come, Mark. But, you hear managers talk about performance over results. Like, Steve Clarke is holding this group to such a high level. And to come out last night and slaughter your team after getting a really impressive result is just, you know, you don't hear it that often.
I hear what you're saying, Damien, but I mean, I thought they were terrible in the two games that they played. They got 6 points, so, you know, that's all that matters at this stage. But, you know, if you carry on playing like they did, I can't remember what day it was now. Was it Sunday against Belarus? But, you know, that was a really bad performance. And the one against Greece. I mean, I've no idea how they won that match. It was, you know, really lucky. So I think you have to, as a manager, you have to pick your sort of moments when you go after the team, and you can't do it too often in public. But I actually think if you look at kind of some of the players that Scotland have got, they should be capable, I think, of playing better. But you are right. Results are absolutely, you know, massively important. I think sort of the Greek hearts were broken by what happened against Scotland. Then they lost to Denmark as well. So, you know, a good opportunity for top two. The Denmark game at home, I mean, I thought that was a really 50-50 match when they played them in Copenhagen. But I do think Scotland need to step up. Can't play like they did in these internationals and expect to beat Denmark, I would say. So I can understand why Clark went after them.
Much is as you would expect. March through most of the groups. France are in control of Group D, Spain Group E, Portugal Group F, the Netherlands Group G, Austria in H. I is Norway, who are absolutely running away with it over Italy. J, Belgium are on top. K are England. But reading your own paper, the Racing Post this morning, the Swiss seem to be impressing some of your odds compilers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Switzerland are kind of just one of them teams that just, you know, they qualify and then they go home, don't they, sort of pretty early on in the tournament itself. But, you know, they're well on top of a group, you know, that includes Sweden. Sweden have actually sacked their manager, Jon Dahl Tomasson, this week after some horrendous results. But if you actually look at the Swedish side, they've got a lot of players now that are playing at really high level. Yeah, Kobel is the Borussia Dortmund goalkeeper. Akanji is at Inter Milan. He was at Man City for a while. Most of their sort of defenders are playing in the Bundesliga. Granit Xhaka is still a very influential player for them and for Sunderland in the Premier League. And then in the wide positions, and Doi, somebody that maybe, you know, hasn't really hit the ground running at Forest, but I think there's been obviously a few issues there with Forest changing manager, which doesn't make that easy. But that they have got a lot of players now that are playing, you know, top leagues. And you were speaking earlier on about Ireland, and it's kind of, you look at maybe not all of the players are playing at the very highest level. That's not the case for somebody like Switzerland now. So that they've got the makings of a team that's playing sort of, if not Champions League, certainly top flight football everywhere. And they are top of a group where I think Sweden have probably been sort of the biggest disappointment in the whole of Europe so far. Jokeres and Isak up front. You got Bergvall, Kulusevski when he's fit in midfield. Absolutely, you know, stuck to the bottom of that group and probably relying on their Nations League form just to get into the playoffs.
Yeah, they will be lucky if they do that. Mark Langdon, thanks so many for taking our call. We have a quick break to take and we will be back with William Buick.
Game on. Racing.
So welcome back to Game On, where we're going to turn our attention to the world of horse racing as this weekend sees the final marquee meeting in Europe run, when Quipco British Champions Day will take place. The starts at 12:55. There are four short price favourites on the card, and the man who rides three of them joins us on the line. William Buick, how are you?
Hi Ruby, I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Good, William. Great, thank God. Good. William, you've had a wonderful year. I know numerically some people will say it's not quite as good as other years, but when you're judging your year or your season the way you would, you've had a fantastic one when it comes to Group 1s.
Yeah, look, it's been a year filled with quality and good horses, you know. And like, you know, better than anyone, you can't do it without them. And I've been lucky to have to have found some good ones this year, obviously starting early at Newmarket in the Guineas and right the way through. I haven't been chasing my tail for winners. But you know, I'm pleased with the season, and you know, very pleased with the horses at my disposal, and you know, you just look forward and keep going, tend not to really think too much about it.
I'm pleased is a bit of an understatement. Again, 1,000 guineas, a 2,000 guineas, the Prince of Wales, the Judmont Gold Cup, a Falmouth Sprint Cup. You can go back to Dubai where you had a wonderful March and April. Pleased, I'd say you're a bit more than that.
Yeah, look, I'm delighted, but like I said, you can't do it without the horses, and yeah, it's on to the next one now, isn't it?
It is, and obviously
coming up now, so
that is the weekend, and it's Kip called British Champions Day. You're starting the first with Trawler Man. He was brilliant at Ascot. He's won this race before. He'll be really hard to beat, won't he?
Yes, look, he's an exceptional stayer. And I believe he's a better horse this year than he was last year. Whether that's a combination of, him just becoming a better horse, and dealing with his races better, bouncing out of his races better, or whether, and also together with that, whether it's we have a better understanding of each other, myself and Trawlerman. He's got an amazing cruising speed. And he keeps it going. He can keep it going the same speed for 2.5 miles, which is a rarity in a flat horse, really. So yeah, a great horse, a joy to ride, and yeah, a horse I always look forward to riding.
He's a brilliant horse for the sport. We don't get to see many 7-year-olds racing on the flat. Godolphin are brilliant to have him and Rebel's Romance. Do you think Charlemagne, surely he'll come back at 8, won't he?
I think that's the plan. I mean, you never, when they're 7 years old, you do take it race by race. But I do seem to remember directly after he won the Ascot Gold Cup, John and Thady were very quick to want to, his main aim was to come back to Ascot in June, to Royal Ascot in June for another crack at the Gold Cup. So I presume that means he'll stay in training, all being well.
It would be great if he does, and it'd be great if he finishes out his season at Ascot with a win on Saturday. The new race on Saturday is the Champions Day 2-year-old Condition Stakes. Looks like it's going to suit you. You have plenty of good 2-year-olds in Godolphin and Words of Truth. Is he going to be your choice on Saturday?
Yeah, he will be he will be the horse I'll be riding, and I th that's a great initiative by the organisers to have this new 6 furlongs 2-year-old conditions race on Champions Day. It's a great opportunity for a lot of horses to race for good prize money for good 2-year-olds, and you can see it's a it's going to be a pretty big field, and yeah, what can I say? Words of Truth, he's a Millreath winner. He's a quality horse, and he's tough. He's just a real hardy 2-year-old that, the more you ask of him, the more he gives to you. And he's bounced out of his race at Newbury really well. I rode him last week. He's in great form, and he's a high class 2-year-old.
He most certainly looks it. So the first two races, you have two outstanding chances. The sprint is up third. You're going to need a bit of luck here on Spy Chief, unless you know something about him that none of the rest of us can see.
Yeah, look, he's he the ability's there. He's not the easiest horse. I'm not quite sure the best way to ride him yet. Whether, he's obviously made the running and been towards the front of his races most of the time. We'll see whether we can come up with something else on Saturday and eke out some improvement. Yeah, look, he is up against it on form, but he has ability.
He most certainly looks like he has. You'll have to change your colours for the fort. The Godolphin blue will come off and you'll put on the Judmon colours where you ride Lakitikia even. She's the second string. Kalpana is the choice of Colin Keane, but François-Henri Graffard doesn't tend to bring horses to the UK just for the sake of a run. He must give this one a chance, does he?
Yeah, exactly that. And I mean, he's got two in the race, Kisisiana as well as Latakia. And look, it's always nice to get the call up for these horses. Francis is a champion trainer in France, and he obviously he most recently won the Arc, so he's had an unbelievable season. And when he sends his horses over, they have to be respected. She won a Group Two in Deauville over a mile and a half in the summer. So if she can, as she probably prefer, getting back on better ground. So if the ground stays good or better for Alaska on Saturday, I think that would help her chances.
It would look that way. The mile, the cute Queen Elizabeth, the mile is the fifth race on the card. You had a go on Fields of Gold back at Goodwood when we last saw him, and he was disappointing. Do you expect him to bounce back? And of course, you will be aboard Carl Sparkler, who would need to improve a lot. But what about Field of Gold? He looked at the world of his at his feet when he won at Ascot. Goodwood, it didn't go his way, but he still didn't finish well enough for me.
No, look, Goodwood was it. It was a very funny race. It was one of those races where you just kind of had to put a line through it. And obviously, he did have a bit of an issue when he came out of the race. But I'd ridden him work at home the week before he ran, or a couple of weeks before he ran, And you know, make no mistake, he's a class horse. So you know, if he's back to his best, he sets a very high standard in what I think is going to be a very good and competitive Q2.
If you couldn't ride Field of Gold and I gave you a chance, would you go Rosalian, Fallen Angel, The Lion in Winter, Never So Brave?
I think you can make a case for all of those, but I if I could have the choice, I would have to go Field of Gold.
Field of Gold. He would definitely be the one I'd say for everyone. Rosalian has been a bit unlucky a few times. But of course, the feature race is the Champions Stakes, the Quipco Champions Stakes at 4:05 on Saturday afternoon. Round three of Ombudsman and Delacroix. Throw in Calandigan. It has the makings of an absolute cracking contest. Are you nervous, excited, looking forward to it?
Very excited. Always look forward to it. Look, it's one hell of a race, isn't it? In many ways, it could produce the race of the season. You know, it's the horses that are very likely to turn up, which is great. It's what you want to see. You know, it's championship racing, and you know, looks like the ground's going to stay good, which will help everybody. So no, it's huge exciting. I mean, Ombudsman is he's a you know he's an unbelievable horse, and what he did at York was he put in an exceptional performance there. And you know, obviously the one worry we would have had going into a Champions Stakes at this time of year would have been, you know, soft to heavy ground, but it looks like we're not going to have that, so that's a huge help to us.
It looks like it'll be decent ground, as you say. There's a few horses in there that could potentially be pacemakers, which might set the race up. Ideally, 10 furlongs in Ascot. Would you like a widest draw and be able to survey the opposition, or what way would you be thinking about it beforehand?
Well, you have to. You play the cards you're dealt, I guess. You know, when the draws come out, you look at it, and then you build up a, you try and work out a you know, a picture of how the race is going to set up, and then, you know, potential pacemakers in the race, and of course the other competition as well as your own horse. But you don't really want to be covering too much ground. You know, an inside draw, you know, helps to get a run around, but of course, you know, then you're looking for a run in the straight. So I'm guessing any sort of single figure draw is pretty good, really. You wouldn't want to be drawn 15 or 15, that's for sure.
He has an incredible turn of foot, Ombudsman. He showed it in York, he showed it at Sandown, he showed it at Ascot. You're thinking about him, do you think if I can get to the two before I press the button, it'll be hard to get by me?
Yeah, I mean, he's a very uncomplicated horse to ride. You know, at York, it probably didn't suit anyone, the pacemaker going as far clear as he did. And don't forget, I was the one doing the chasing from half a mile out. Now, chasing a horse that's, you know, 20, 25 lengths in front of you, half a mile out, and in a Group One race, that's a hard thing to do, and then still produce the turn of foot he did the last inside the last furlong. You know, that was an incredible performance. So hopefully we won't have to deal with a pacemaker that's that far in front of us. But you know, he, like I say, I know I've always said it, and you know, he can adapt to any sort of situation. He could sit back off a strong pace like he did in the Prince of Wales. The Eclipse was a mess, but it showed there that, you know, you pretty much place him anywhere in the race. And at York, you know, he didn't have any cover. He's chasing down a pacemaker that's way in front and still kept on quickening. So he has no set way of racing. He's a very adaptable horse, and he has all the attributes of a top class racehorse.
That also makes it hard for the opposition when you're trying to weigh up a horse that can be ridden any which way. It makes it almost harder for the opposition to beat you.
Yeah, and it's like you know yourself, when you ride a horse that you can adapt to the way the race pans out, it makes you can go out then and with a plan, and if you have to change plan, well, then you have to change a plan. So you know, we'll sort of cross that bridge when we get to it. But yeah, I've always thought that's one of his real attributes is the fact that he can do it from any which way.
He most certainly can. Obviously, the Balmoral handicap will round out the card, but best of luck to that one. Your thoughts will be on all the group ones on Saturday afternoon at this point. William, from Ascot, I'm sure you'll be Breeders' Cup bound. Melbourne Cup as well, or not?
Not, unfortunately, not this year. Would have been nice to have gone down again, had another crack at it, but not going to make it down this year. So, just the American now.
William, before we let you go, it is a big night in Dublin tonight. Ireland are playing Armenia, but obviously you have Norwegian roots. What about the Norwegian football team? I mean, their pathway to the qualification for the World Cup has been incredible.
Yeah. Well, the individual players, they have got some team. For a small country of only 5.5 million people, they produce some of the world's best footballers. Great to watch.
They most certainly are. Best of luck on Saturday, and thanks a million for taking our call, and game on.
Thanks, Ruby. Appreciate it.
Game on. Racing. This is 2FM. Game on. Soccer.
Andrew, welcome back to the programme. Extended until 10 o'clock. Coverage of the Republic of Ireland against Armenia, the World Cup qualifier to come. 7:45 kickoff. Keith Tracy, Pat Fenlon will be with Marie, and Kenny Cunningham will be alongside our match commentator as team news tonight. Good evening, John Kenny.
Evening to you, Damien. Yeah, two changes from the game against Portugal for the Republic of Ireland tonight. Josh Cullen, as we know, suspended. Got a second yellow card in the group, and that was on Saturday. He's replaced by Will Smallbone of Millwall. He's currently on loan there from Southampton, so he'll be playing in midfield. And Finn Azaz of Southampton, he replaces Chidozie Ogbeni. So two changes for the Republic of Ireland. So it's Kelleher in goal, O'Brien, Collins and O'Shea, the trio at the centre of the Irish defence. Then you've got the wing-backs in Seamus Coleman and Ryan Banning left and right. And in the middle, Smallbone along with Jason Malumbi, who I thought was excellent against Portugal on Saturday. Festi Ebuzeli, who went off injured and indeed booked in that game as well, thought that maybe his place would have been under threat, but he retains his place alongside Finn Azaz, who, as I say, is one of two changes, and Evan Ferguson up front. Armenia, well, the one we have to look at really is Edward Spertian of Krasnodar. He's earning his 38th cap tonight. He's scored three goals in three games against the Republic of Ireland. So he's the man I think they really have to look out for tonight in the Armenian side.
Thank you very much to John Kenny. So as mentioned, John will be alongside Kenny for commentary of the game. Marie to be joined by Keith and Pat. So obviously we all want to be part of the 48 teams who will be in Canada, Mexico and the United States next year. I've been exploring the history of the Soccer World Cup itself with journalist Jonathan Wilson. And his new book, The Power and the Glory, A New History of the World Cup. I had the opportunity to speak to him earlier. Began by asking him what it was about the history of the tournament which inspired him to so meticulously look back through the history of the Soccer World Cup.
I think the slightly strange thing is we maybe haven't taken it seriously recently. So there's been lots of very good books, lots of very good documentaries, lots of very good work on individual tournaments. But looking at the thing as a whole, there hasn't really been an in-depth book since Brian Glanville's story of the World Cup, which I think he first wrote, I think it was 1973 when he first wrote that. Then he kept updating it. That's a great book. It's a seminal book of English sports journalism. But Brian was writing from his notebook. That's how you had to do it in those days. It was what he'd seen, people he'd talked to. He didn't have the chance that our generation has, that you can pay $5 and you can sign up to the Argentinian National Library and you can access pretty much any newspaper that's ever been written in Argentina, as an example. So we have way more sources, way more documents. It's much easier to get in touch with people these days than it was when Brian was working. I say this as I was a friend of Brian. He was a great influence on me. He was incredibly helpful to me, and that's a great book. But it's a book from that era, and I think it maybe the magnitude of that book has put other people off. It seemed that the World Cup was ripe for re-examination using the tools and the resources we have today.
Does what we know about the World Cup, has that been changed as well by the scandals that have engulfed FIFA in recent years? Like, does the perspective need to change?
I think that's possibly true. I think that's certainly added a level of complexity. I think what's happened, and I guess this is tangentially related to the scandals, but the way that Russia and Qatar, for instance, have very obviously used the World Cup or used hosting the World Cup, I think that's made us aware of what a political event it is. I think it's always been political. I think, I mean, you look at Mussolini in 1934, and that's the most blatant sports washing you'll ever see. Not that anybody used the term at the time. So I think you're right. I think, I mean, Qatar particularly, although it was also true in Russia, the very naked, very blatant use of the tournament for political ends has possibly, you know, brought into focus what was going on before.
You mentioned the fact that people have potentially fallen out of love with the World Cup. Is that because of the image of FIFA? Is it because of saturation of world football? Or what has led to maybe that slight apathy that has grown?
I think it probably is disillusionment. I think FIFA is such a... when was FIFA last a good thing? You know, it's very hard to find good news stories out of FIFA. I should say, the FIFA library, totally different kettle of fish. They are great people who are really helpful. And I think that's actually, the sad truth is a lot of people at FIFA are really good and are incredibly gifted and incredibly talented, working for the right reasons. The top tier, less so. So I think the excess, the obvious corruption in various votes, I think that probably has led to disillusionment. And I think more than that, Qatar is the great example. And I was very, very conscious of this all the time when I was there, that every time I went to a stadium, every time I went to a media facility, every time I went to a hotel, every time I went to an apartment complex, everything you went to, you knew what the human cost of building that was. Mm. You knew that the facilities you were using had been built with the blood of migrant labourers. And that's a very, very difficult thing to reconcile. And at the same time, you've got some of the greatest football we've ever seen being played. And the two things are true. We shouldn't say the football's awful because the background is awful, but you have to keep both those things in mind.
I want to come back to some of the tournaments and maybe the appropriation or misappropriation of the World Cup that's taken place. But let's go back to the very start. And, in the way that people are often confused or surprised to hear that the Tour de France started as a promotional tool for a newspaper, like the origins of the World Cup, if the Olympic movement had been more proactive about embracing football, would the World Cup have ever materialised?
It would have to have embraced professional football. I think that's the issue. And I think even then it would have been difficult. So the 24 and 28 Olympics, I mean, Uruguay, who won them both, say they're World Cups. And to be honest, they're right. They're global tournaments, the best teams in the world, with, the exception of the United Kingdom nations and a couple of countries who professionalised early. They are there in 24 and 28. And I think it's reasonable to say Uruguay were the best team in the world in 24 and 28. Possibly they'd have lost to England or Scotland, possibly. But basically, those Olympic tournaments were huge. I think 1924, I think the stat is that a third of all revenues at that Olympics came from a football tournament. So that's how big it was. It was completely dwarfing everything else. In both 24 and 28, the football had to be held before the main Olympics just because it required so many people. There wasn't the accommodation, there wasn't the infrastructure to have it going on at the same time as everything else. So you could see even if you accepted amateur football as being the height of the game, it was an effort to fit that in. But Jules Rimet, who I think was a great FIFA president, I think there's not much doubt he's the greatest FIFA president, both in terms of how effective he was as an administrator and just in terms of his moral virtue. I mean, he was a very devout Catholic. The reason he got into sport was because he saw sport as a way of elevating the working classes. He'd read Pope Leo XIII's encyclical of 1891, talking about the plight of the working classes, where the encyclical says, sport is one of the ways that people can get out of penury.
Muscular Christianity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, muscular Christianity, I think, has got certain connotations because the way it's used in the British public schools. But the idea that the physical activity that wasn't related to industry was a benefit and a virtue in itself. And Rimet was absolutely inspired by that. He set up his own football club in Paris to try and break down class divisions, where he gave poetry readings to try and sort of stimulate the sort of cultural leanings of people who'd grown up in poverty. And he saw amateurism as sort of being a block on allowing all people to play the game. That if you insist on on very strict amateurism, then you have to have money already, or you can't commit time to training, you can't commit time to going off to play in tournaments.
Yeah, but
so that's why he wanted a professional tournament, and that's why in 1930 we get that first World Cup.
Yeah, but the aspiration, though, that the World Cup would be a tool through which brotherhood of nations would be built, like the wheels fell off that wagon very, very quickly when the reality of the competitive nature, you know, kicked in.
Yeah, that's very true. Rime was an idealist in that sense. I think he genuinely felt that you know, if countries are playing sport against each other in this sort of friendly environment, this spirit of friendly competition, that can only be good. I think certainly by 1934, when Mussolini's got his hands on it, he's realised that that's not always the way it's going to go. And you know, some of the photos of Rime in the stand near Mussolini at that tournament, you can see his disgust, his distaste, his unease. But then, to be fair to Rime, he seizes it back by 38. He gets it to France rather than to Nazi Germany. He is French. And in a weird way, given everything that's going on around it, 1938 is the least political of World Cups, certainly in terms of the host nation sort of expressing some great vision of itself. Mm. France is almost entirely absent in 38. But obviously you have this 15 teams there because Austria withdraw late after the Anschluss. Spain aren't there because of the war. Japan aren't there because of the invasion of China. Yeah, the politics are there, but they're not coming from a host nation.
I love the quote on the back of the book from Tom Holland. It's a history of the World Cup that is also a four-yearly temperature check on the history of the entire world. And when you frame the tournaments in that political landscape, like that is such a succinct summation of what the World Cup has become.
Completely, yeah. And when I was writing it, I was very conscious that, for a long time, I don't mention Gulf nations. And then suddenly, after the oil shock in 1973, the Gulf nations are massively important. And obviously now, in terms of the funding of football, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar are massively important. So, I mean, that's a very simple example of how, by tracing the history of football, you trace the growing importance of the Middle East in global politics. And what I found myself doing, because obviously one of the challenges of a book like this is you could easily write a book on every single World Cup. Mm. Whereas this, there's 22 tournaments that happen, so to squeeze that down to a manageable volume. Every tournament has to be around about 7,500 words, each chapter, which really isn't very much. If you're going to tell people what they, who won, what were the great goals, what were the great games, who were the great players, but also what did this mean? Why was this important? And also try to give people something they haven't already heard to try and find new details or new ideas, new theories. Yeah, that's the real challenge. So the way I sort of tried to structure each chapter was, I wrote down a word or a theme for each chapter. I'm not going to remember them all now, but for instance, 1966, post-colonialism, 1974, the Cold War. And 74, there's so much stuff going on. That was the most fun chapter to write in a way, because there's so much. That obviously you've got total football, you've got West Germany winning at the last. That's the stuff that people know. And in a sense, that's about the rise of boomerism as well. But also you've got Zaire there as the first black African nation. You've got Chile there after the Soviets have refused to play them because of they wanted to play a playoff in Estadio Nacional, which had been used as a torture and execution centre after the Pinochet coup against Allende. You're an elected Marxist. You've got the after effects of the oil shock. You've got West Germany playing East Germany. Shortly after, Willy Brandt, the West German Chancellor, who'd had this policy, his Ostpolitik, of reaching out to the East. In that April, so like 2 months, just over 2 months before the start of the tournament, his chief advisor has been revealed as a Stasi spy. Mm. You've got this great paranoia after the terror attacks of the Olympics 2 years earlier. And even the sort of the atmosphere, the weather, the fact that it rained so much in that tournament, there's this damp, paranoid feel to that tournament. And I think that's the 1974 World Cup is a great way into what was global politics like in 1974 in the wake of the oil shock with the Cold War tight.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the role that the World Cup can play or has played in the international image of a number of countries. And Germany is the one that's most intriguing. So you've got post-war re-emergence, say, in 1954. You've got that issue, as you've addressed it, in 1974. And then you've got a sense of a modern Germany in 1990. And, listen, I'm not saying football
is the mirror, the complete definitive mirror on the world. But you can learn an awful lot, or you can make statements about where certain countries are at based on the vision of themselves that the World Cup allows them to send around the world.
Yeah, I think that's been true from the start. I mean, why did Uruguay want to host it? It's because they'd realised that in 24 and 28, by winning the Olympics, by becoming this sort of really celebrated team, people suddenly have heard of Uruguay. It's not just a northern state of Argentina, that it is its own place. And yeah, I think West Germany. And I think what's interesting is you get the sort of primary truth of what you're saying, but you also get a secondary truth. So the miracle of Bern, 54, West Germany coming out of the war, looking for global acceptance. In some ways, 54, that World Cup, which they win, is West Germany for the first time after the Second World War, walking with pride on the global stage. Mm. But actually, what you realise is, even that is slightly an invention of a reunified state after 1990, that in 54, everybody was very anxious and very nervous. So, for instance, in the stadium after the final whistle, the national anthem but sung includes the first two verses, which officially had been struck off for being too sort of nationalistic, too militaristic. But yeah, either people forget in the height of emotion, or they don't know, or they don't care, but they sing the full Deutschland über alles rather than a much more sort of peaceful third verse. And you know, radio coverage has to be cut because this is seen as this great embarrassment. Mm. And you read the sort of German papers of that time, and they say, well, it's only football. We shouldn't be sort of banging our own drum too hard about this. And then you realise after 1990, people are looking back. Once the state's been reunified, and they're looking to tell the story of the Bundesrepublik of West Germany, they're sort of looking for this origin story. And 54 is a really useful way of doing that. And people have been doing that. You know, there's various films, various novels have played with the idea, but in the 1990s, it becomes almost, you know, Das Wunder von Bern, the miracle of Bern, becomes this sort of, this is the moment when West Germany was born. And you realise even that is a sort of post hoc invention. And that, I think, is really interesting. It tells you a lot about modern Germany, their way of reconciling to the fact that Germany was partitioned, and the reasons for that partition have to be explained, and they use football for 50 years, 40 years after the fact.
Game on. Soccer.
Let's return to our conversation with Jonathan Wilson about his new book, The Power and the Glory, A New History of the World Cup. And at this point, we started chatting about Brazil's defeat in the 1950 final. It was played in front of in excess of 173,000 people at the specially built Maracanã. And it's bizarre because that defeat tends to resonate more with people in Brazil still than their five subsequent World Cup wins.
I think it still does resonate more. I think, you know, if you think back to the 7-1 in when they lost to Germany in the semi-final in 2014, I think one of the background factors in that was the pressure that Brazil felt to win on home soil after what had happened in 1950. So 173,000 is the official attendance, almost certainly 30,000, 40,000 more than that packed into the Maracanã. Mm. And yeah, as the rest of the world's coming out of the war, Brazil has been only tangentially involved in the war. They have therefore become, in relative terms, you know, wealthier over the course of the war. They've been able to invest in stadiums. There's this sense that, you know, Brazil is this new republic. I mean, it only gained full independence in the 1880s. And yeah, this spate of building, the Maracanã is the great centerpiece of this incredibly modern, incredibly striking stadium. It's sort of the representative of the heart of a nation, and it's meant to be the theatre in which this great victory is played out. And they only need a draw in that final game, don't forget, and they go 1-0 up, and then they concede twice and they've lost, and the sense of shock is clearly devastating. And then, you know, Pelé talks about how Pelé grew up in a very poor home, and that is just a very rare occasion when his parents had friends round, and he sort of remembers his dad and all his dad's mates sitting around, having a drink, having some food, listening to the game on the radio. And then when they lose, you know, his dad being in tears, and Pelé says it was the first time he'd ever seen his dad cry. Mm. And Pelé's response to that was himself to cry, to go into his room, very basic room, had a crucifix on the wall, knelt down in front of the crucifix and sort of said, yeah, Jesus, why have you let this happen? And then went back, hugged his dad and said, don't worry, I'll win you one of these. And then, of course, 8 years later, age 17, there he is in Stockholm, scoring twice in the final, as Brazil do win the World Cup for the first time. But that doesn't wipe away the stain of 1950, and none of the subsequent four wipe away the stain of 1950. That is you know, various playwrights have described it as their, I mean, Nelson Rodriguez describes it as our Hiroshima, which feels a bit distasteful, a bit over the top. But that sense of a national disaster, a national tragedy, I think that is very real.
They win in 58, they win in 62, they win in 70. And that 70 World Cup, is there almost a sense of that is the end of the Jules Rimet, whatever remnants left of what he envisaged a World Cup to be are dead and buried. And João Havelange, another Brazilian, drives it on and it becomes the commercial beast that we know today.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And there's a very nice symbolism that that's the last tournament which the Jules Rimet trophy is used, because Brazil are rewarded it having won it three times, that we moved to the modern World Cup trophy by 74. Yeah, and a couple of weeks before the tournament in West Germany in 74, Havelange is elected and places Stanley Rouse as FIFA president. And Stanley Rouse tends to get quite a bad rap these days. I think it's a little bit unfair. You know, he's portrayed as this very sort of tweedy colonial Englishman, which isn't really true at all. You know, he's a school teacher. He's a son of a grocer. You know, he'd been a promising player, was a goalkeeper, got injured, became a referee. Refereed the 1934 FA Cup final. He developed the modern style of refereeing, the sort of diagonal style, as it's called. So the referee tends to stay on the opposite side of the pitch to the linesman. Very thoughtful about the game. He's one of the great architects of the austerity Olympics in London in 48, which is why he gets his knighthood. He's very pro expanding the World Cup. He wants to take the 32 teams as early as 1974, and he's blocked by UEFA. So he's not anti having more African teams or more Asian teams or more North and Central American teams. He's very pro it. He just can't get it through. But Havelange is able to portray him as this sort of colonial old buffer. And Rouse, I think, gets it very wrong in South Africa. Mm. Rouse's policy is FIFA don't engage in politics. It's up to each country to determine how it wants to run itself. I think when that country is then refusing to send a mixed race team, I think that does become FIFA's issue, but Rouse stepped back from that, and Havelange was able to use that.
Mm.
But for Havelange to portray himself as the anti-colonial candidate when he's the son of a Belgian arms dealer, it's some reach. And then he introduces this age of rampant commercialism. I think the commercialism was building slowly. Rouse wasn't totally unaware of that, but Havelange certainly opens the door much more widely. But also Havelange brings in the world of corruption we know today.
Yeah, I want to go quick fire through a couple of the tournaments. And I know I'm conscious that you're stuck for time. But 1978, to speak of politics, is it lazy in 2025 to still ask you, did the junta win the World Cup for Argentina?
I mean, they definitely created the environment in which it happened, and that clearly did benefit Argentina. I guess the big question is what happened in that game against Peru. So in the second group phase, Argentina needs to beat Peru by four clear goals to get to the final ahead of Brazil, and they win it 6-0. If you watch the game, if you didn't know any background, what you'd see is a madly passionate atmosphere in Rosario, and you'd see Peru midway through the second half just sort of melting, sort of thinking, well, hang on, there's nothing on this for us. Why are we bothering? As Argentina come in wave after wave after wave of attack. Some of the conspiracy theories around that, I think, slightly nonsensical. Quiroga, the Peru goalkeeper, was born in Argentina. And so there's all this, he was letting them in. He was brilliant. He made some amazing saves. There's stories about this Peruvian player was taken off when they were 1-0 up, when Argentina were 1-0 up to help Argentina. And then you look at it, he actually went off when they were already 4-0 up. But the weird thing is that Videla, the head of the junta, and Henry Kissinger visited the Peru team in the dressing room before kickoff. And why on earth would that happen unless there was an attempt to... I mean, what was Kissinger doing there anyway? Back when I did Angels with Dirty Faces, so this is, 12 years ago when I was writing it, I did write to Henry Kissinger's office and say what was going on, and just got a very short note back saying, Dr. Kissinger has no recollection of this incident, which I suspect might be a pretty much a pro forma answer to a lot of questions Henry Kissinger's obfuscated about his behaviour in the 70s. Yeah, but anyway,
copy and paste and send that to whoever is inquiring about whatever else. 1990, it changed this country. And there's great romance in Ireland about that tournament. And I know Cameroon were the other story of the tournament. Maybe I'm naively thinking we resonated with people beyond Europe or beyond this little island of ours. But we need to be realistic. It was actually a horrendous World Cup all in.
Well, it depends what you want from a World Cup. If you're looking for football, it was a horrendous World Cup. But if you're looking for stories, and I tend to think the stories are more important. That's a great World Cup. I mean, yes, Ireland, Cameroon. England. I mean, gazetteers are a big thing in the development of English football. West Germany in the last nation before unification. Czechoslovakia in their last tournament. Soviet Union in the last tournament. Yugoslavia in the last tournament before they fall apart. Italy going through this extraordinary psychodrama. Argentina going through, losing to Cameroon in that opening game. Somehow playing awful, awful football. Dragging their way through to the final. And then, Maradona going back to, obviously playing his club football in Naples, but going to Naples. And Argentina beating Italy in the semi-final on penalties. Extraordinary, dramatic, operatic game. I think the setting was incredible. I mean, as we now know a lot of those stadiums weren't particularly well built. Mm. But at the time, if you'd grown up watching English football in our dilapidated stadiums, and you see these extraordinary arenas, it just felt like football from another world. And so I think everything about that tournament, I think it's the most operatic tournament.
Yeah.
And much like a lot of operas, it's the drama that carries it. And let's not examine the details of the plot too closely. But it's the level of emotion in that tournament, I think, was like nothing else.
Yeah, you've a couple of comments about the GAA and their relationship with soccer in Ireland that, I won't get into it now, but I think it'll intrigue people, how perhaps the GAA is seen outside of this island of ours. I'm not going to get into 2002 because Saipan, it's the second Irish Civil War. There's a new film coming out about it next week, so I'm not going to, we'll leave that where it is. When people talk to you about the World Cup, you've talked there about 74 being the one that you enjoyed most, which is the tournament that has resonated most with people? Which is the tournament that you're asked about more than any other?
I think it probably is 1990. Mainly because people I've talked about the book are either English or Irish. So.
Okay.
I think for both nations, it's a huge marker. And maybe it's partly as well that a lot of the people who are currently in the media, for them it was a formative age for them. I think everybody has a fascination with their first World Cup. Being sort of a precocious, annoying child, I was 5 in 1982, and I turned 6 during the tournament. And I remember that very, very clearly, very vividly. And so for me, that will always be what a World Cup should look like. But looking back, that tournament was hugely important for me in terms of just sort of showing football as this sort of window to the world. These countries I never heard of before. Suddenly, I could have told you the capital, the currency, the flag of all 24 competing nations in 82. I just absorbed a phenomenal amount of information. Yeah. And I think as well, my generation, late 40s, because 82 was a Spanish-speaking World Cup. 78, which we're looking back to, had been a Spanish-speaking World Cup. 86, a Spanish-speaking World Cup. 90, Italian-speaking. The World Cup always felt a very, very Latin event. And I think that's conditioned how we see it. And there's no reason for it to be no reason to think of it as a Mundial rather than a World Cup. And yet somehow we do.
It's a fascinating read, and some of the stories, it's not a sequence of match reports. It's far from that. It's stories of people and countries and the intricacies of global politics played out against the mirror of football. It's a really fascinating read. The Power and the Glory, A New History of the World Cup, written by Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time and congratulations on a fantastic piece of work.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Game on. Soccer.